Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
As if you need any more evidence that Governor Kevin Stitt is more political peacock than problem solver, look no further than his recent expansion of Operation SAFE, the governor's roundup of unhoused folks from public byways, first in Tulsa and now in Oklahoma City. It may be cynical, but it feels oh so very Marie Antoinette-esque. Stitt, as you know, lives in a swanky oak tree mansion in North Edmond, the first governor in my memory who determined that the state's historic governor's mansion was beneath him and his family. So naturally, Stitt would be most concerned about appearances, right? Priority number one, get all those vagabonds and shantytowns to disappear. So he puts an already manpower-strapped state highway patrol to work rousting the unhoused, paving the way for other state workers to come in and eliminate all the evidence that state government leadership is indifferent to the plight of the least among us. Out of sight, out of mind, voila. A harsh assessment, yes, but it's reality. The public policy approach Stitt and far too many of his Republican supermajority colleagues are taking ranges from indifference to disdain. Meanwhile, Jesus wept. For the record, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's latest point-in-time surveys put the number of unhoused in Oklahoma City earlier this year at 1,882, up 2.4% from 2024. And in Tulsa at 1,449, up 4% from 2024. Those working to solve the growing affordable housing crisis and to help serve the unhoused tell us that in Oklahoma City alone, about 2,000 homeless students are enrolled in K-12 public schools at any time. Overall, nearly 22,000 unhoused individuals were served last year by public-private programs, according to the Homeless Management Information System. Rather than Operation SAFE, the governor's program ought to be called what it is, Operation Clean Sweep. Oh sure, he promotes the notion that state troopers are working to connect the unhoused with public-private help programs, but those are temporary fixes, not long-term solutions to a problem that threatens to get worse as our economy becomes increasingly shaky. To help us get a better understanding of what's happening to our fellow Sooners and of what could be done from a public policy standpoint to give them a hand up, we are joined for this week's ObserverCast by, well, someone who needs no introduction, but I'll give him a brief one anyway. Fifth-term Oklahoma City Rep and House Democratic Whip, Forrest Bennett, whose House District 92 encompasses most of downtown and stretches from near the fairgrounds on the Capitol's northwest side to Valley Brook in the southeast near the crossroads of Interstates 35 and 240. Forrest, it's great to have you back.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. This is, I can't believe we're still having these conversations, but did you get any kind of a heads up or that this was coming again?
I did not, but I'm told that some leaders, municipal leaders, were tipped off that it was going to happen, and that their response was generally, please don't do that. And so in so far as they were able to mitigate some of this, the partnership that Stitt said he had with Key to Home, which is a public-private partnership, did make this a little less bad. And I'm using my words specifically, less bad and not better, because Key to Home helps insofar as there are housing for the folks that are experiencing homelessness in Oklahoma City. And we have a housing shortage. Anyway, that wasn't the question you asked, and I'm rambling on.
Well, that's what we do best on this this podcast, I think. Why does it seem so difficult?
Oh my God! Sorry.
to get the legislature to try to come up with some kind of a long-term solution here? Is it just because these are folks who are so marginalized that there's no sense of urgency, or are so many legislators, because a lot of them, I guess, are maybe from areas that don't see what we see in the urban areas as frequently.
Well, there's so much there. First of all, when we have these conversations, as a legislature, I've mentioned before, this is more of an urban issue, and my rural colleagues will take exception to that and say, no, we're seeing homelessness out in our areas as well. But I think what it comes down to is a big difference in how you think of the issue. One being that you see people that are homeless and you want to solve the problem. And then there are people who see homelessness and don't want to see it. And we can put Operation Safe squarely in that second category. I mean, it was nice that Stitt connected with Key to Home, though he only did that at the behest of local leaders. And he has said, I'm not looking to solve homelessness. I'm just looking to clean up the city. And to me, as a policymaker, you are not cleaning up the city, quote unquote, if you are not striking at the problem as opposed to just trying to erase it from people's eyesight. And you can look no further than the fact that a few years ago, he disbanded the Governor's Council on Homelessness, which was an interagency council that planned these things out and tried to work on a comprehensive approach. He disbanded it. I still find, and his reasoning for that was, well, they can get together, and the nonprofits and other groups that are dealing with, they can get together and figure this out. That's what that was for. That's what that was for. So, I mean, it seems really counterintuitive, at best, and cruel at worst, you know?
So I think this is a great example of, well, first of all, let's just back up to what Stitt did in Tulsa and how he responded to it, right? When he got pushback, just, I mean, his response was absolutely callous, right? Calling the people who are concerned with the unhoused, do-gooders, and I mean, really disparaging the people that do the work of working with these communities every day, really showing his failure to even try to expend any intellectual effort to understand this, right? That's a line a professor wrote on a paper of mine one time when I did a really terrible job once, and I'll never forget it, but it was so apropos. And I mean, he just hasn't even tried to, to understand these issues, the causes, the consequences of his actions. But then to like see him like it's almost like when he decided to do this in Oklahoma City, he decided he was going to try and be nice. And like his version of being nice is actually still being really awful.
Yeah.
It's like he's trying to kind of correct from the way he responded to it in Tulsa by saying, I'm not trying to solve it. I'm like, you are just a jerk,
Yeah,
and
and
so,
it's consistent. It's consistent with the way that he has governed over the last 7 years.
absolutely. He doesn't want to deal with policy. He never
No.
wants to deal with policy.
You remember the teacher shortages and his brilliant plan to bring professionals in off the street, so to speak, and his thing of
Off the streets, right?
we're going to get people to take a break from their day jobs and come in and teach. And he genuinely thought that he had hit a home run with that. To say nothing of the fact that very few people voluntarily participated in that program, but it also spoke to the lack of understanding that he has about teachers and how they are specifically trained and educated to be educators, that it is not as simple as someone changing careers. It is that teachers in an ever increasingly complex learning environment are being educated and doing, continuing education every year to make sure that they're at the top of their game to educate the future of Oklahoma. And that was his response. So if I'm going to be positive about the governor in this case, I will say that he is consistently disinterested in learning how government works, what the best truly comprehensive solutions are, and the subject matter expertise of the people on the ground, given whatever circumstance it is, whether that's education or poverty.
Anything, any substance, any policy issue of substance, right? He has just, I mean, oh my God, his absolute laziness at even trying to govern is amazing.
It is.
I mean, but I mean, just the consequences of Operation Safe in Tulsa and Oklahoma City, though, especially on the heels of the Trump administration, trying to federalize cities across the United States, just that trying to preempt, local authority, calling in the National Guard from other states to go to other states, just this manipulation. It was like st trying to be Trump-like, and this. And what's weird is it's like at the same time, it's like he's trying to present himself as a moderate in many ways.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when
That's what passes
it
for
was like
moderate,
the
I guess,
children
right?
are off limits when we're talking about ICE raids. They're like, oh wait, you care? Like he's like doing these really like half measure like stances on things because he's got to get a job in another year.
Right. And he's figured out that he's exhausted all opportunities for further elected office, I think.
Because, yeah, and he's like he's been too extreme or ineffective, or I mean, it's not that he's even been ineffective. He's done shit.
Yeah.
I mean, no, sorry. He privatized Medicaid. He did do that.
By the way, I'm not sure that he understands that he's his road to further elective office is
He's at a dead
as
end.
difficult as his career.
Do you think
He's
he's holding out? You think he's holding out hope?
I think he absolutely is. He
What's next
absolutely.
for him? Like the Senate?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The U.S. Senate's the first step. This guy thinks he could be president. I mean, he really does.
Oh yeah, those were the
It's
whispers
insane.
back in back when people were thinking about running against Biden, and then everybody endorsed DeSantis, and that's been wiped from the internet because
Yep.
Trump. I mean, it's just so crazy. It's and I guess neither he nor Ryan Walters passed the sniff test to be part of Trump's cabinet.
Well, and he didn't have a chance after the DeSantis business,
Right.
because
Right. The
Trump does
wedge
that.
hole there.
One thing he doesn't forget is if he feels like he's been,
Slighted. Yep.
yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. But
Which is
I,
totally a Trump, which is also something Stitt does.
well, it
Yep.
is, and I guess we try to armchair psychologists this way too much, but you think this guy grew up, his dad was a minister. I don't get. It wasn't like his dad was a mega church minister, and they lived lavishly based on everything that I can tell. But somehow, he had some success in business. Some of it by not playing by the rules, clearly. But and then all of a sudden, he just thinks he's arrived. And this should, to me, should disabuse any notion once and for all that we need a businessman,
Yeah.
to run the state of Oklahoma. I mean, this has been the worst, 7+ years that you can imagine in terms of just total ineptitude.
And then just the tone deafness of, he proclaims November Family Month and puts out this proclamation encouraging families to eat around the kitchen table more this month. And it's like, are you not going to say anything about the fact that costs of groceries are skyrocketing, as well as the property insurance for that house all that family's gathered in, and the health insurance should something go wrong with that meal and that person get sick? I mean,
And SNAP
God.
benefits being cut for how many hundreds of thousands of Oklahomans?
It is just, I mean, it almost it, it's that coupled with the Hunger Games style gala that Trump had for Halloween at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, it's just, it's there. It's offensive. I mean, to me, as an American and as an Oklahoman, for there to be that kind of flippant attitude I mean, from Trump, you expect it, and I guess we're supposed to expect it from Stitt as well, but I was just floored, and it's hard for me to get surprised anymore by any of these folks, but was just floored with the tone deaf nature of that, you know?
And obviously, I mean, he's been elected twice, so I don't think we can let our fellow Oklahomans off the hook here on all this. But I do think there's something in the Oklahoma ethos, and I love Oklahoma. I grew up here. I chose to come back here as an adult, but I want so much more for my state than it's delivering. But I don't, I think there are a fair number of folks out there who believe that these folks who are hanging out at the curbside holding up signs or living in the shanty towns, it's a failing, it's a moral failing on their part in most cases, and just a lack of willingness to get off their duffs and go to work. I think there's a fair amount of, even though most Oklahomans hang by a thread financially, I
While
just don't
working.
get that.
I mean, so many of the people that receive SNAP right now are hardworking single moms. And yes, I'm sure there are other people that get SNAP that maybe don't work quite as hard as they're supposed to, or whatever. I mean, we shouldn't create a monolith of the people that rely on SNAP, but the vast majority of the people that rely on that program are people who work hard in one capacity or another. I mean, and I think about like, yeah, certainly like the single mom who works multiple jobs, and I know someone like that. I was listening to her talk to somebody else at her job the other day about their SNAP, and her concerns. But then I think about, my older brother lives right next door to my mom, and she has Alzheimer's, and he's had to cut back hours at work so that he can take care of her because he's the one who's in town, and he kind of, he and my dad and my brothers and I, we all kind of split that, but we're all taking time out of our lives. And thank goodness we have enough people to kind of spread that work out. But there are people who are doing real serious hard work that is not compensated, like caring for a loved one. And that, we could have a whole policy conversation about taking care of those folks, but those are also people who are relying on SNAP, not just for themselves, but maybe for the person they're taking care of, because the cost of healthcare is so damn expensive. So and so much uncertainty around Medicaid, Medicare, all that. So it's just a shame that we have leaders, and I just don't feel like it should be a partisan issue. And I think that there are quietly, well, I know that there are Republicans that work on this, that see it more compassionately. But this is, one of those machismo guys that I think, I honestly only think that there may be some attitude of, man, how weak must you have to be to rely on SNAP? I mean, it's a pretty hard scrabble life, actually, when you're relying on SNAP and navigating the bureaucracy to access all of that. I mean, it is difficult and expensive to be poor, and Stitt does not know that because he has never experienced that. Anyway, sorry for the rant.
Well, I mean, that man. I just, but also, I mean, just like the notion that he just wanted to clean the streets and not actually help,
That he was willing to say that.
right? I mean, so in Tulsa, my understanding is that, okay, not only did they sweep the camps, which meant people lost their property, but they also got pushed onto private property from public property.
Right. And we
And
passed
then,
legislation that makes both of those illegal, effectively making homelessness illegal without doing a damn thing to help those folks. I mean, it's
and not, and so if we kind of position this within the discussion of like the SNAP issue right now, right? Like there's multiple pieces of this. So there's, what's going on at the federal level. The Democrats are refusing. Well, so first of all, the Republicans are not calling anything into session in the House. They've been out of session for 6 weeks. And the Democrats are saying, well, we're not going to agree to this budget because it does nothing to help with the health insurance subsidies that individuals get on the marketplace. Therefore, people are getting priced out of health insurance, and so that's their stopping point. So we had this government shutdown. SNAP benefits are announced that they're going to be cut on November 1st, although people are saying they appropriated those dollars. Those funds should be available. And so the Trump administration, like, I don't know what you're talking about, right? The judges come out this weekend and say, no, they have to use those funds. And then Trump comes today. This blew my mind when Trump was like, we're only going to do 50% of it. And I'm like,
Yeah.
you're the most insolent little child, right? When he's like, oh, we'll do 50% of SNAP dollars. Meanwhile, you have these people in Oklahoma. You know, we're, what Stitt and the Speaker of the House were like, oh, we'll come up with some way to what fund it at, what was it, $1 million a month
Yeah, for the whole state, yeah.
for the whole state. When we have how many billions of dollars in a rainy day fund?
Yeah, and I mean, and it speaks to the need. It speaks to the fact that Oklahoma is such a reliant, we are so reliant on federal dollars for programs, and have been for time immemorial, you know. And my Republican colleagues love to talk shit about the federal government, but then expect them to come in and fund the things that they know that that we need to provide. And now all of a sudden, their buddy up at the White House is shutting that off. And I also find it funny, you know, that Trump's narrative about this just totally blows out of the water Mike Johnson's arguments that, you know, well, we're trying and this is awful and we're devastated by this. Trump clearly is like, well, no, I mean, if I'm forced to spend money, I'm going to spend less than than I can. I mean, what does that say? What does that say? The guy that's having a Hunger Games style banquet at
Yeah,
Mar-a-Lago while
Great
people are
Gatsby,
starving,
you
he's
know,
like,
to
okay,
be
fine, I'll give
completely.
50%.
Well, it's so petulant, but the fact is we have no enforcement mechanisms right now to make the USDA disperse those dollars. Like, we have nothing in place right now. And so you have like this just insanely callous approach to sweeping the encamp, you know, the encampments for the unhoused in Oklahoma City and Tulsa, all for show, while the safety net is non-existent right now during a government shutdown. And all they can say is hold a little press conference and say, yeah, we'll throw $1 million at it.
Yeah, it's a sad deal. And the reality is, like, there are solutions to this. And
Yes, and they're cheaper than anything.
well, and I, you know, so how quickly we forget, you know, COVID and how everybody kind of had a clarity of mind about policy during that time, that of course, you know, people shouldn't be evicted from their homes because of financial catastrophes that are no fault of their own, that people need access to health care, that, you know, people need, you know, money in their pockets to feed themselves and their families. And here we are in a scenario that is going to put people in a similar spot, but entirely of our own making. And those lessons seem to have been forgotten by people like Governor Stitt. And it's a sad thing because the people, I mean, yeah, I represent most of downtown, and there are a lot of west of downtown and in downtown, there are a lot of services that support people who are experiencing poverty. And they've said for years, you know, we're stretched thin, and they've also provided for years, you know, examples of things that we can do to help. And the state is not going to be the silver bullet answer to this, but we could chip in money to build affordable housing, which is something that the governor has said outright. Under my watch, we're not spending money on building housing. I mean, he said that. Like, these are things that the guy has said, and then he turns around. I mean, just the tone deaf nature of this guy to say, yeah, I'm going to disband the Interagency Council on Homelessness. Yeah, I vow to never spend money on housing as long as I'm governor. Yeah, let's proclaim this Family Month and encourage people to eat while it's very well publicized that thousands of Oklahomans are finding it very difficult to find food right now. It is remarkable. And it's frustrating to me that my Republican colleagues who privately are frustrated with this are not saying so publicly.
I do sense, though, and maybe I'm I have a little Pollyanna sometimes, I think, in my view of things, but I do think Republicans are beginning to squirm about these things. And you see it in the press releases that suddenly are coming out. And I keep rolling back to Stephanie Bice and, and James Lankford's doing the same thing. You know, it's the Democrats' fault that all this stuff's happening in Washington. And, if they'll just, come back in and be willing to pass this continuing resolution, we can solve all these problems. And of course, that ignores the fact that it's useless at this point to sit down and negotiate a deal with the House and the Senate in D.C., for example, on SNAP and and the healthcare subsidies and so forth, when the next day Donald Trump could say, "No, I'm not going to do that," and they will just all over, fall into line on it, and nothing, nothing will occur anyway, except that Democrats lose their bargaining chip. And I sort of think that people are beginning to see a big, they're not, they may not entirely understand what is going on here and why this is happening, but I would still argue, and I realize this isn't on the homelessness issue, but it's part of this whole problem of government not functioning properly in our society today. I'm absolutely convinced that Mike Johnson sending the House home had less to do with whether or not people got SNAP benefits and things like that. I think he's worried about having to seat a newly elected Democratic congressperson who would be the 218th signee that would unlock the Epstein files. And that's what this is really all about at the end of the day. And
Well, and
so
it's convenient
people are
because it's a district.
suffering, are going to suffer enormously, whether it's lack of SNAP benefits or their healthcare premiums skyrocketing, those kinds of things. And at the end of the day, they're just going to be mad. And they're going to be mad at the people who are in power, I think. I
Yeah,
hope.
and the average person may not have the wherewithal to know, they'll just be like they're bickering again, and it's at our expense. And I can understand that. It's a shame, but I hate that just about every national conversation about the shutdown is framed around who's winning and who's losing the messaging argument, as opposed to, let's lay it out there, let's lay it plain. Yeah, this is convenient for the Trump administration because Russ Vought gets to do Project 2025 stuff. Trump gets to usurp more power because Congress is out and he has an absolute sycophant, Mike Johnson, who's willing to literally keep Congress away from DC so that they can't negotiate with the Democrats. That it has been stated that the Republicans have been, informed that they should not negotiate with Democrats until Trump says so. And he doesn't want the government to come back. I mean, and I find this all morbidly fascinating because, I mean, the reality is that there's a good chance the government could be out for a long, long time because that's what Trump wants. And I've seen small cracks in the armor, like, Johnson and some of the Senate Republicans saying we don't want to kill the filibuster because someday that may come back to bite us, despite Trump saying that you should do that. And I find that interesting because it's the sort of the one area where they have not just done his bidding. It'll be interesting to see how it all works out. But in the meantime, yeah, on top of, people who are already suffering and need SNAP, you're going to have a whole new group of people who are reliant on, the charity of others. And charitable organizations are stretched thin in places like Oklahoma. So I hate it, and I want to make sure that if, anybody listening to this hears a politician say, I'm frustrated at the blame game too. And that it seems so policy, wonky up there in DC. But we cannot lose sight of the fact that this is not a simple, normal partisan bickering scenario. There are unprecedented things happening in Washington because of Donald Trump, and there is a staggering compliance going on the part of Republicans in Congress. As a legislator, I'm begging my congressional counterparts to, if nothing else, have some pride in the branch of government you're in and exert your authority. I mean, this three-legged stool of democracy that we have is pretty brilliant, if the three branches are effectively providing the checks and balances on one another that they're supposed to. And right now, that's just not happening. And it is remarkable. And for it to be so that, Trump and Russ can spend money that Congress is supposed to be able to be designated to spend, or it's to protect whoever is in the Epstein files. I mean, it's obvious to me, and I think it's obvious to anybody that's paying a modicum of attention, that it's very hard for Mike Johnson to argue anything else with regard to Adelita Grijalva. But that we're all so tired of this and numb to this that it's not, all of these stories should be dominating everyone's mind, but it's just so overwhelming that we can't do it. And obviously, many of us are now distracted by the fact that our loved ones are going to suffer. I'm upset.
Well, I think we all are. It's outrageous, but I wonder if you had the magic wand, and would there be what would be your blueprint for instead of sending the highway patrol, into the cities to round folks up and the transportation department to come behind and clean up, what's left of their belongings in their grocery cart or whatever. What would you, how do you begin the process? This is the unhoused. There are a lot of tentacles to this. There's a lot to take on, and it sort of has to all be put together, I think, to be somewhat efficient.
Exactly. It requires a very complex solution. And I mean, I think, for me, it starts with housing. And I think the state in partnership with counties and municipalities could prop up some housing that they can utilize in the short term. And we have the issue of some folks, not being in a mental place to be able to go with authorities and accept that they're going to go into a shelter. And for those folks, obviously, mental health needs need to be addressed. And you're not going to have, 100% success rate. There were going to be people that remain. But this issue of trying to clean up areas, I mean, in Tulsa, they're just the same people are popping up elsewhere. And the problem is they're popping up without their stuff. And their stuff oftentimes included their birth certificate or some type of ID, the very things that they need in order to claw themselves out of the position that they're in. And so, first of all, do not separate people from their loved ones or from their vital documents. Two, find a place for the people who are willing to go to stay while we triage the situation for them. Three, identify the people who are unwilling. Also identify the veterans because there are specific programs for veterans that they can get plugged into. And eliminate the barriers. There are organizations in Oklahoma City that welcome people who are on the street, but they require certain things of them. And there are certain sort of addiction scenarios where people just simply cannot adhere to to sort of that barrier. And it sort of negates the problem. So, I mean, the solution. So, with a magic wand, you're still not going to be able to create true magic. It's still going to be, an imperfect solution, and it's not going to catch everyone. But it can go a long way. And then you have, a policy package that can be proven to work, which can encourage both policymakers on one end to increase that, and then also people experiencing homelessness on the other end to be able to see that, hear from their peers, so to speak, that yeah, this actually is an effective solution. You know, partner with people like Curbside Chronicle that are getting people off of the street and putting them into work. Support those social enterprise programs. You know, these things, especially as we are having this conversation about skilled labor, and people being, you know, taken off the streets in this mass deportation scenario. Okay, if that's the case, let's find work for folks who are willing to do it in exchange for housing. I mean, there's just a lot of creative solutions that we could explore if only we had a governor who had not preemptively sworn off exploring any of those solutions.
I agree with you. I you know, that's where you really sort of miss the leadership, and I think in the governor's office. But the reality too is the legislative leadership bears responsibility in all this for not being forward thinking enough. And clearly there must not be any sort of political pressure to, you know, to do more than they're doing. And this, you know, we're sort of at a crisis enough stage right now that a guy like Kevin Stitt can order the Highway Patrol and other state agencies in to sort of sweep the streets. It's reached a level, at least for him, that he wants to make this production. But I think there's a potential that for things to get much worse. You know, the economy's soft in a lot of ways. It's kind of weird. You know, we've got this ongoing, you know, federal government shutdown, and it could, you know, by the time the legislature returns to session in February, we could have chaos like we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
And no plan to fix it based on what I can see. Because any efforts, you know, from, and you're right, there have been Republicans who have been involved in this too. You know, let's look at this on an interim study type situation, but you can't generate enough support to move the ball at all, even to get it hiked.
Which is one of the more infuriating things about being in the legislature is where you can see that there are a number of people in a bipartisan manner willing to do something, but the system allows for a few people to keep us from being able to kind of explore that, you know. And I was thinking about Tammy West, who's done the Caring for Caretakers Act and is continuing to build on that to provide a little bit of help for the people that are caretaking for their loved ones. You know, and that is one of those last lines of defense between people who are down on their luck, being homeless, and being cared for. I mean, in my mom's case, it's because of this, you know, this terminal disease that she's dealing with. For others, it could be a temporary, you know, accident where they need help. But it is so easy, and we're seeing, you know, I think that that's a big takeaway that we need to be talking more about, is that the fact that, you know, we're minting new billionaires every day in this country, on the one hand, and we are seeing a lot of people stressed to the point that they are obviously one missed paycheck away from experiencing poverty, more than we've ever seen in modern times. And that is a policy failure. That is a policy failure. To think that there are 11,000 or 1,100 billionaires out there, each one of them sitting on enough money to solve this problem, if we tax them. You know, I had somebody reach out to me. They took a screenshot that said that you've maxed out of your Social Security contribution, and he didn't understand what that was. And I said, "You got a pay raise, I guess." And he said, "Yep." I said, "Yeah, your pay has reached above where Social Security gets taken out. It doesn't, you know, if you make $300,000 or something, I think some of that income is not subject to Social Security." That fix alone could bring in so much money for us as a government to help people, and make Social Security solvent. This is just one little thing, but it is indicative of the nature of politics today, where obviously well-heeled people have lobbied the federal government to the point that rich people do not contribute the vast majority of their income to Social Security, and therefore the rest of us who are struggling to make ends meet as we work can count on the fact that we're also going to have to struggle to make ends meet when we're done working, if that ever happens. So I mean, yeah, truly, truly spiraling towards a Hunger Games type world here in America, which I can't believe. But luckily, I grew up in the generation where we read those books and watched those movies, and I think I'm ready to go.
So, I guess I'm kind of trying to figure out where we go from here. It seems to me the best things that we're seeing happen in terms of actually trying to deal with issues like the unhoused and affordable housing and that sort of thing is happening at the local level. And I'm not sure that people fully appreciate how lucky folks in Tulsa and Oklahoma City are to have the mayoral leadership that they do in those two cities. And I say that acknowledging that we gave David Holt more than his share of darts probably when he was in the legislature for votes that he took. But he and now Monroe Nichols in Tulsa, they get it, and they seem to, they seem to understand the problem, what the issues are, and how to begin to solve them. I guess the problem is the municipalities don't have the financial firepower and wherewithal that the Congress has and that the legislature has because of, the way that they're funded, because of the way that municipalities are funded in this state. So they can have all the best ideas in the world. I'm just not sure that they can they can do much more than put a Band-Aid on a hemorrhaging wound.
Yeah, no joke. I think, first of all, David Holt's evolution on policy is genuine. I've seen him. Yeah, I mean, I remember him asking me for the endorsement when he was still in the state Senate. And our caucus retreat right now is at Ocana. The House Democrats meet, in the fall every year to kind of build our agenda and talk about the year to come and all that. And this year we're doing it at Ocana for the first time. I think about how Holt was like the vote that kept his he had a no vote that kept the state from advancing the what was then, I can't remember what they called it before, they called it the First American Museum, but and now here he is like championing it, and celebrating that we are a city that's becoming sort of a cultural capital for indigenous people across the country. And it's genuine. And Monroe ran on ending functional homelessness. And he is trying things here and there, and there's trial and error to it, but there is a concerted effort in both of these places, to do something sustainable. I think that is, what we really need to drive home are the actions we are going to take sustainable in combating this? Because when the legislature passed those bills that just basically made it illegal to camp on public lands and then can't illegal to have encampments on private property, we said, and I specifically said, look, you think that you're solving this problem, and you're going to go home and you're going to tell your constituents we solved that problem, but it will not be solved. And one of these days, you're going to have constituents to go, I thought that you told me you solved this, you didn't. And so that was my impassioned plea to my colleagues to go back to the drawing board and put some more teeth in this, figure out, how to make this a sustainable thing. But of course, that would require compassion and funding, and those are two things that are equally hard to come by sometimes at the Capitol.
Is it, does it, I guess part of me wonders if in this sausage making process, if not only do you need some leadership to emerge, but it needs to emerge around sort of a certain, some certain core ideas maybe. Am I wrong to equate it a little bit to, my thoughts about Chris Steele's efforts on criminal justice reform, which have not fully blossomed after all these years, but we are at least headed in the right direction on some of these things. It fits and starts like everything, I think, in public policy. But this was a guy who, he had a vision. He could see what was needed, and people were able to rally around him. He was able to build a constituency for something that, a lot of folks in Oklahoma, criminal, if you do the crime, you do the time. They just don't care. I wonder if you need almost something like that, a Chris Steele type figure or several figures, and certain goals that are easily understandable for folks to understand why this is important.
It would be nice to have it.
We just don't know who that is.
It would need to be, you know what I mean? Like I have some optimism for Kyle Hilbert. His first year, his effort was to sort of rework the way the legislative process worked. He's a new generation. His district is a mix of suburban and rural. But now, he's in charge of a caucus that spans the spectrum of urban to rural. He's got a bright mind and obviously has to navigate a lot of nasty politics on his side of the aisle, and I don't necessarily envy him for that. But if you had a Kyle Hilbert as speaker, Gintner, Drummond as governor kind of thing, or even better if Cindy Munson's governor. And she can make sort of these, let's rebuild the safety net, sort of a central tenet of her governorship, and just say, look, I'm going to use the veto pen on a lot of things until you come to the table with something like this. She would also need, a veto override proof majority or minority in the House. So obviously these things are somewhat pie in the sky at this point, but it's also something that we can tangibly point to and say, these are our goals as Democrats in Oklahoma. We want to get somebody in the governor's office, and we want to get enough members in the House that we can stop the backslide to crazy town that's going on right now. And then you can have a bipartisan work, to create those goals. And I think, to a degree, watching what happens in Tulsa. Since Mayor Nichols specifically said, my goal is to eradicate functional homelessness within 6 years, I think, which is clever because that means that he'll run for re-election, and if he hasn't solved homelessness quite yet, they can't hit him for that. And I don't mean that flippantly. I think that
No.
was smart of him because this is a very complex problem and it's not easy to fix. And he's facing a lot of pushback up there from some corners. But if he, championing that, if he can figure it out, then I think that there will be an effect there, a domino effect of, okay, well, it can be done if you put the right resources to it, and obviously these are all big ifs and these are all hypotheticals and theoreticals right now, but at least we have leaders, high profile leaders, talking about it, and not talking about it in the way that Stitt has been talking about it over the last few days. That's just been. I just can't get over how tone deaf some of that stuff has been.
Well, and it does strike me, and I think, folks who are listening, I hope they get this, but I want to reinforce it. This is not something, this sort of intractability, inability to get things done at 23rd and Lincoln, it has evolved even more over the last 40 years, in terms of these sorts of things, because you start thinking about, the Reagan era and sort of popularizing this notion of the Cadillac driving welfare queen,
Right.
And so people, a lot of folks have been conditioned to sort of assume that people who are unhoused in a lot of cases, again, are just they're lazy or they're working the system, or if they're getting SNAP, they're working the system in some sort of way, and the reality is just the opposite. I mean, yes, there are people, who are going to work the system, but they're few and far between, I think. You have a lot more physicians who work the system on Robin Medicare than you do, I think, folks, trying to work the system on SNAP. Those benefits are hardly, the sorts of things that you could build an empire around, but it seems to me it's just it this is a sort of thing that's going to take time, and it's going to maybe it's going to take some cataclysmic events of some sort that, and maybe nothing short of another Great Depression, which I don't wish on us or anybody else, but things getting so bad that you have to it forces people to sort of put aside some of this nonsense and actually try to do something.
It does seem like it's unfortunately real that extreme policy reform only follows extreme disruption. And we go back to the COVID example there. That sort of people, I mean, just remarkable how ideologies kind of melted away, and Republicans and Democrats alike were like, oh yeah, no, rental assistance, yeah. I mean, and not everybody. Obviously, there were people that were horrified by it because, wow, how much compassion in public policy. But, and it wasn't perfect. There were, it was hard to deliver that kind of funding that quickly, but we can learn a lot from that. The shame for me is that, yes, to your point, people have to feel it. And I used to ask myself and my colleagues, who needs to feel this in order for them to do something? And then, it occurred to me, like, there are pockets of my district that have been experiencing this kind of poverty for a long time. It's not the fact that we're waiting around until enough people experiencing it. We are waiting around until the right people experiencing it. And that's not, I hate to say it that way, because I don't want anybody, just like you, I do not wish, abject poverty and mass poverty on anybody, any community, any society. But the sad fact is, it seems that unless someone right in front of that person, Marjorie Taylor Greene's family, for example, one of the reasons that she's hot about the healthcare issues is that she has family members who rely on the ACA. Yeah, it's far from perfect. It is the product of a serious, hatchet job that the insurance lobby did to a program that started out very well-meaning, trying to create something similar to a public option. But it got Christmas treed up by the special interests, and yet it now, 15 years later or whatever it is still the preeminent law that allows people who cannot get health care through their employer to access much needed health care. And the subsidies were what made it affordable for people, because the health insurance industry would not allow the prices to be cut because they rely on that to line their pockets. So, my hope is that in this conversation, for example, the idea of a public option and eventual single payer health care becomes more mainstream, that the Overton window of conversations around healthcare policy moves to the left in that way on that. And if we do see a second Great Depression as a result of direct result of Trump's reckless policies, we saw what happened after the last one. I mean, it was FDR, and it was the Works Project Administration, and it was serious social reforms. I hate it, but I think you're right, Arnold, that it might require that kind of mass suffering, and it shouldn't, it shouldn't. And my deep desire is for people to look to the people who are putting themselves up for political office and asking themselves, is this someone who needs to be forced into a corner by a mass event? Or is this someone who comes equipped with the compassion and intellectual curiosity to figure this out before that it gets that bad? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, and it makes me think we basically have a year now till the next election. So if people aren't yet fully engaged in paying attention, this is probably a really good time to do it and to start figuring out who's really working for workaday folks in this country and who's not.
Right.
And so, this is a great opportunity. But it's gonna take some effort. And my dear friend Frosty Troy used to always say that it's the price of living in this country that we do that we'd have to do the homework. We have to roll our sleeves up and pay attention and hold our leadership accountable. And I think, unfortunately, too many of us have been on our smartphones or iPads or whatever, playing Spider Solitaire. Well, that's what old guys like me do, at least, to pay as close of attention as we probably needed to. But, well, we knew we could not solve some of these problems in a 45-minute to an hour conversation, but I really appreciate you taking the time to join us, and I think we want to continue to do this probably in the months ahead and try and figure out ways that we can help move the ball forward, because this problem isn't going away, and it's very likely, I think, going to get worse before it gets better.
I worry about what comes next. But this is big cathartic, and it's appreciated by me that you had me on. My district was certainly impacted by Operation Safe, and I remain frustrated that my colleagues won't hear me on really solving the problem. But it is consistent with every other policy conversation we have, whether that's education, incarceration, healthcare, reproductive healthcare. There's a consistency to this. Not listening to the experts and not having the curiosity and drive to get to the heart of the issue. And so my hope is that anybody listening to this that's interested in getting into public policy keeps that in mind, that, there's a moral argument for solving problems for folks. There's also a financial one, which is that, when you invest on the front end in preventative care, in healthcare, housing, for all, accessible healthcare, free public education that's good, that's genuinely an equalizer for people, that all of those things work together in concert to create a society that's healthier and wealthier, and sort of primed for success, and that benefits everyone. And what we have right now is a world that has been retooled by the wealthy to continue to benefit the wealthy. And the rest of us, regardless of our differences, should get together and mutually be upset about that, and then resolve to do something about it. But in the meantime, we'll keep chatting, Arnie.
We will preach on, and we may have to break our hymnals out here. Listen, thanks much, and we'll see you soon.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.